Welcome to Inside the Spec. We are the podcast that bridges the gap between building product manufacturers and the architects who specify them. Each episode brings you unfiltered insights into how architects find, evaluate, and specify building materials. I'm your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, and CEO of Point to Point. We're an advertising agency focused in securing the architect's spec through results-focused marketing. And I'm joined by my co-host, Mardan Mehta, a second-gen architect and founder of AceLab. AceLab is an AI-driven product selection platform that brings architects and manufacturers together early in the design process.
Whether you're a manufacturer looking to better serve the architectural community or a supplier seeking to understand the evolving needs of design professionals, Inside the Spec delivers actionable intelligence straight from the source. Inside the Spec, because understanding how architects think is the first step to becoming the architect standard.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Inside the Spec. I'm your host, Megan Kavinsky, CEO of Point to Point. I'm joined by my fabulous co-host, Mardan Mehta, CEO of AceLab. And this one is a little different from some of our prior content. Today, we are going to be talking to Amy Baker and Joost Fanu about what is going on at CSI. What does the industry need to know? And if you're like, what's going on at CSI? I haven't heard about it. This episode is for you. But before we get into it, I want to address the fact that this is very time sensitive and sort of a sensitive topic overall. And so what we're endeavoring to do today is to provide education and background and dialogue about what's happening in our industry. We also have a disclaimer that we want to read because we want to be clear that these are just the opinions and dialogue of the people that are on the call or that are leading the discussion today. This is not, everyone can come to their own conclusions, and we encourage you to do your own research as well.
Yeah, super. Thanks, Megan. So here's the disclaimer, and then we'll get started with the discussion, which should be very exciting. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are those of the individual panelists and do not represent the official positions of their employers, firms, clients, or any professional organizations or industry associations with which they are affiliated or hold the membership. This discussion is intended to be educational and informational only and does not constitute any legal advice. Listeners should speak with legal authority for guidance on specifics to their own situation. Any intellectual property referenced in this article belongs to its respective owners. We make no claim of ownership over any trademarks or copyrights mentioned. So with this, let's just start with the basics. I'm sure we've got variants in the audience on how much they know about CSI, about master format, and so on. So let's start with the basics. We'll start with Amy. So Amy, if you could maybe walk us through, just to set the stage, what is CSI? What's the master format? What's the construction standard? And why is all of this so relevant to our industry?
Sure. So CSI, the Construction Specifications Institute, is not just for specifiers like myself. It's an organization made up of specifiers, architects, engineers, building product manufacturers, and, you know, even owners, facilities managers. So it's for everybody. And it has been a nonprofit for a long time, founded in 1948. There are, I think, according to the website, about 6,000 members. So it's not a small organization. There's a lot of volunteers and local chapters and at a national level who participate in developing standards that CSI has available for the industry.
Amy, can you give us a little bit more of your background? I mean, you did mention in there, I'm a specifier. Can you give us a little bit more on your career and your relationship with CSI?
Sure. So I am a registered architect and also a specifications consultant. I own a small firm, and we not only provide architectural services to building owners for commercial projects, but we write specifications as a consultant to other architects. So we are definitely touching base with a lot of different firms and helping them coordinate their project specifications.
Great. And then maybe as the other half of this to set the stage here, Amy, what's changed? Why is everybody talking about CSI so much online and threads and so forth. It'd be helpful to understand from you what has changed recently and who is actually affected by these changes.
So a little over, I think, 3 weeks ago, we were all made aware of some changes around the licensing of what we call master format. That's probably the part that most people are familiar with, even though a lot of people don't necessarily know it by name. But master format is one of the classification systems that architects, engineers, and specifiers use to organize our information. And we'll see that not only in our project manuals and our specifications, we'll also see that numbering system show up in other places, like in construction administration tasks and just the way we organize our information on our own servers and our own firms. So it is a classification system. And master format, as I mentioned, is probably the most widely adopted in the industry today.
Just anything to add to the background here about CSI and master format and the new changes that we've all found out about a few weeks ago?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, maybe I'll just introduce myself very quickly. So my name is Just Fanu. I am the founder of Bibliotheque. We're kind of like a building product manufacturer's library. But before that, or I guess in parallel to that, I'm also a specifications writer in Canada. I own a firm very much like Amy. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't have the pleasure of being a registered architect, but I write specifications for other architects who kind of like engage our firm on a consulting basis. I also have the distinct pleasure of currently being the target of a lawsuit by CSI. So I have quite a bit of information on this. So, you know, a lot of people might have found out about this 3 weeks ago, but I've been dealing with this in the background for the better half of 2 years now, I would say. So to add to what Amy has said, I think that master format is one of the classification standards, but certainly it's not the only one. There are other standards called UniFormat and OmniClass. So CSI claims ownership of these standards. And I think that when I started looking into this, what I realized is that ownership in IP law, and again, I'm certainly not an IP lawyer, it's just somebody that has done way too much research on this. But what I've realized that is there are three kind of like very high classes of like IP ownership. So you have copyrights, you have trademarks, and then you have patents. And they all kind of like work together to protect, right, like what, you know, people create. So I know more about kind of like what the law is in Canada versus in the United States, but there are some principles that are somewhat universal, right? So you can copyright a work in the sense that say I have a really good idea. It's like, hey, you know what? I think of like, I'm going to go to the moon, right? Like, you know, I can't copyright that because that's in my head. So in order for somebody to be able to copyright that, like they have to be able to put that into something that's tangible, right? So i.e. on a piece of paper, in a book, on a recording, etc., etc. And then there's, again, that super, super high level. Again, I'm not an IP lawyer. Then there's trademarks. So trademarks is I have come up with a distinguished brand, and I want to make sure that people only use that in a certain way so that it doesn't tarnish my brand. So think of Nike, think of Coca-Cola, right? Like I can't go out and create a product and call that Coca-Cola, right? Like I would get sued, right? So that would be like a trademark. And then there's patents. So patents is I have a really good system, like I have an invention that's kind of like brand new. And then I want to make sure that nobody else does that, right? So, but again, like a lot of times, like you're talking about like mechanical devices, you're talking about like actual things, right? Like, so a big one in the industry, like you might remember, for a really long time, only one company could make fiberglass smart face gypsum board. That was kind of like what we call paperless drywall, right? Like, so that patent was owned by USG, and they were like literally the only ones that you could get it out of. But now, again, by definition, because the government doesn't want, or usually like, you know, whoever makes the law doesn't want that to be indefinite, they give you that monopoly for a certain number of times. So after a certain number of time, that patent expires. And also by definition, in order to create a patent, you have to make that you have to say what's in there, right? Like you can say, hey, I have the secret sauce, but nobody can know what it is. Like you have to say, hey, that's what it is. So the moment your patent expires, you're going to get a whole bunch of copycats because, you know, your formula is exposed. So that's the weakness of patent too. So what we are facing right now is that CSI claims that they have quote unquote IP over our standards, but it's not very clear what that IP is. Is it copyright? Is it trademark? Is it a patent? Nobody knows. So anyway, I hope that wasn't too much of a lengthy introduction on the topic, but that's where
I'm good impersonation of a patent attorney there, Juiced.
You know, I try. Yeah. Spending way too much time with LLM, so.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I want to try and make clear here is that we're not debating whether the classification system should exist or not. But we're not debating which classification system is better, because as we mentioned, there's a couple different ones that are out there. What we're talking about, the crux of it, is that a classification system that has been available, was created by a community, available through a nonprofit, did have some licensing fees behind it, but not in the way that they do now, has dramatically changed their model to the point where now anyone who's using these classification systems, architectural firms, manufacturers, and whoever you are, anyone who's using it is supposed to be paying a licensing fee or licensing the CSI platform to have access or the right to use that numbering system. And so my hunch is that the majority of the viewers of this, that if CSI has 6,000 active members, right? There's a lot more than 6,000 people in our industry who are using, you know, this classification system and their marketing materials and their content libraries and their, you know, installation guide, all these things, right? Yeah. So that's really the crux of what we're trying to talk about today, is this change in the model of how you're able to access that information, right?
I think it has been a change in the model. So there, the current position, which I encourage everybody to kind of look at the website for CSI and also the construction standard, which is the licensing itself, for further clarification. There are frequently asked question pages that everybody can reference. But as it has been up until this point, a person who has purchased one of the master format books, for example, has a license to use that book through the purchase of that book. So that's in theory how the licensing has occurred up until this point. There have also been free master format lookup tools, I believe, available online up until like 2016 or so. So I think it's fair to say that CSI has encouraged the usage of master format and has built a lot of education around it. And it has been widely adopted in the industry. And even so far as, you know, certain kinds of contracts, government projects, university work might require its use as well. So adoption has been pretty universally established at this point. And as an industry, we're now very well entwined with it. So the change being that now firms can expect to have a potential new licensing requirement in the form of a new tool that's been developed called CSI Dynamic Standards. That will be the path forward, which is the change. Meaning previously, if you had a book, you can still use that license in that book the way it's described. That's your individual license that you're allowed to use. But if you're like me and have a small firm and you hire someone new who doesn't own that book, your firm is now subject to licensing through CSI Dynamic Standards, which currently is the only option available. We can't just buy a new book. Those are no longer available for purchase. So that essentially is the change, is in how they're asking to resolve the licensing issue. It's changing from book format to software format.
Can I jump
one time fee to annual fee, right?
Recurring
monthly revenue, right?
Yeah. And,
that's right.
Can I put a hypothetical for everybody, just kind of like as a little bit of a thought experiment, if we will. So let's say I bought, you know, like, I don't know how many of you have kids, but I'm assuming some of the listeners do. So let's say I bought a shirt for, because I have a toddler and I have a 7-year-old, right? So I kept all the clothes for, like, you know, my daughter when she was younger so that I could pass it on to the other child. So imagine that, you know, I bought those clothes and then the company Carter or whatever says, well, no, you can't, you know, use those clothes on your new child, right? Like, you have to buy brand new clothes, right? So I think that's very similar to what they're saying. Like, every member of the firm should have a copy of the book, to me, in my view, at least. Again, like, it's completely nonsensical, right? Like, and how do libraries work, right? The whole point of a library is that you have a reference book that people can then go and then, like, borrow and then look up things in it, right? Like, so the thing with copyright, again, like, me not being a copyright lawyer or what have you, I'm just doing my impression here. But the thing with copyright is that you own the work, but you do not own the ideas inside the work, right? So if I came up with a diagram on how to make a rocket ship, and then I choose to publish that, then somebody can look at my diagram and my formulas and then go build their own rocket ship, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of times with, you know, like with master format, what it has been, it has, like, the document has been, hey, if the industry could just kind of, like, get behind organizing construction this way, then we would all be much better off because everybody would know where to look for stuff, right? So certainly I can go out and make my own classification system and call it Format Master, and then, like, just add one digit to all the numbers and publish that as a competing standard. But in my view, there's nothing stopping me from looking into the book and saying, hey, you know what? I have a piece of drywall here. I'm going to call that 092116. I have a piece of stud, like, I have a stud here. I'm going to call that 092216, right? So that is taking what's inside the book and then applying it to other things, right? I have a library. I'm going to, like, classify that. And if you kind of, like, look at the application guide inside the book, I mean, I think even to, like, the 2020 edition, they literally say you can use it, like, it's you know, master format is used for project manuals, TTCC, and other applications. So to me, implicitly, even their guidance says this is not just supposed to be for these applications. It's supposed to be a tool that you can use for different things. So yeah. So again, like, I can write my book. You can copy my book, but I can certainly not copyright the ideas inside the book.
So, Jules, you seem to have a pretty good handle on copyright law for an upbeat, you know,
I know nothing
because you have 2 years of experience here. Can you talk about what sort of legal precedents might exist for something like this to be, because there are, my understanding is that there are some active lawsuits that are out there, not just yours, but others. You know, what are some of the arguments that you're hearing about why this might work for CSI and why this might not work for CSI?
Yeah, so there's another case. I mean, as far as I know, there's another case that CSI is actively pursuing in the U.S. right now against a company called ZeroDocs. And CSI, again, to the best of my understanding, CSI sued them in California for, you know, doing something very similar to what I'm doing. Like, they have a library and they kind of, like, organize it according to the library. So CSI is currently suing for copyright infringement. I've read some of the briefs that were kind of, like, posted out there. Like, I think they are currently cross motion for summary judgment. So that just means the, you know, both parties submitted their arguments in front of a judge, and then the judge is going to decide on that, or decide whether to go to trial. So from my reading of it, again, like, me certainly not being a copyright lawyer, some of the arguments have been, like, again, this is settled law in the United States. There was a case, and I don't remember the name of the case, you have to look that up. But it was a case of an accountant who kind of, like, put out a book for, like, a system of accounting. Like, here's how we're going to keep the ledger, etc., etc. And his book didn't do very well. And then somebody else came out with another book, kind of, like, describing a very similar system. And then that book picked up. And then obviously, you know, first author is kind of, like, pissed off and says, well, you know what? You copied my system. And, you know, and then this is back in the 1800s, right? So then, you know, Congress kind of, like, said, no, well, you own the book, but you don't own the system that's described inside the book. So certainly if you kind of like put out the book out there, then somebody can take those ideas and then go make their own or apply them or, you know, what have you. So it's pretty settled law. And I think there's something in your Copyright Act that says that, like, you know, in no way shall anybody be able to, you know, copyright systems, procedures, etc., etc., etc. So that can be looked up as well. So a system is not copyrightable. In Canada, we don't have it codified in the same way as you have it in the US. But for example, in my current lawsuit with CSI, you know, again, like without speaking too much about the details, one of the arguments that we put in front of them was like, okay, well, what did we copy, right? Like, can you tell us, just give us a, that's called a request for particulars. So when somebody sues you, you kind of like ask like, hey, what did I do wrong, right? And they wouldn't tell us. So they were like, well, here it's including, but not limited to this. And I mean, like, again, like you have to know lawyers, right? Like they want to be very specific in the language. So it's like, well, is it including this? Is it just this? Like, can you tell us a little bit? So we spent the better half of a year trying to figure that out. And there's a decision that came out in our case recently because we said, well, you know, either you tell us or we are asking the court to remove some of that part from your claim. And the judge did not only remove that part from the claim, the judge struck, i.e. for construction terms, revite and resubmit. So this is kind of like putting a shop drawing stamp and saying, you know what, not good enough, revite and resubmit. So the judge did that. And then they said in their descriptions, like, if you won't tell us what the work is, but you're describing it as a system or as a book or as what it is, if it's a system, then it's not copyrightable. If it's a book, then we ought to see the book, right? So now they've kind of like resubmitted and then say, okay, well, it's actually the book. So we're dealing with that. But anyway, it just kind of like shows you that, like, again, like based on my little understanding of how things are, you can copyright a system, or it's very hard at least to copyright a system.
Definitely a loaded topic, but let's talk about the real world impact now across the industry. So, you know, let's start with, again, since you guys are a part of the industry, let's start with what impact do you foresee this having in your own practices? You know, you could talk about it in terms of workflows or adoption of standards or financial impact, anything you guys would like to share there. And then maybe we can like go through some other stakeholders in the industry as well that we know are supposed to be impacted by this if this were to continue.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And there is currently a lot of information on the Construction Standard website that describes, in their words, the sort of net to be cast. So again, I encourage everybody to look at that for exactly who is subject to licensing and how and all of that. But as an architect and a specifier or someone in an engineering firm, the way we understand it, and this has been a topic that's been kind of confusing, that they've since started to clarify for us. If you're a subscriber to a software platform that gives you, like, quote unquote, Office Master spec, they are subject to their own licensing to be able to use the system in their product. We as architects and specifiers and engineers are still subject to licensing separately from that. So if you subscribe to a software platform for spec writing, that does not get passed on to you as the user of that software. So we are also needing to provide for our own licensing, either by owning the book as an individual, because that's an individual license per person, or by subscribing to CSI Dynamic Standards as a firm. That's how I understand this works at this point. So, you know, for many small firm owners in particular, with 30 days notice, I'm not sure everybody is prepared to receive an invoice from CSI. I'm not actually sure how they plan to roll that out to the extent that they'd hit all firms everywhere. So I'm not sure what the rollout of that looks like or the enforcement of it. Those are questions that have not yet been answered. But, you know, but how it's described on the website is that all AE firms should expect to be subject to the licensing if they're using one of these taxonomies or numbering systems, master format being the one I think we're all most familiar with. So.
And you know, so Amy, just just as a follow-up to that, how do you foresee the behavioral change in the industry, if any, from the AE firm or spec writer side? Like, do you feel that there's a chance that firms will start to abandon some of these standards and try to find like alternatives that might be open source? Or do you feel like this is just a sure thing that one way or another, CSI will eventually enforce this with firms and firms will have no option but just to comply with it in some
A really tricky thing to answer. It's kind of like looking into a crystal ball, but I can tell you that there are a lot of folks who have discussed the possibility of coming up with an alternative taxonomy as a result of this. I think that the time it would spend to do that and then, you know, implementation and adoption would be quite a heavy lift, but there's a lot of people that are interested in working on that right now, as far as I know. I think that the response, at least that I've seen, is that it's got a potential to kind of fracture the industry's use of master format, meaning, you know, hypothetically, if the net to be cast includes architects, engineers, spec writing consultants, manufacturers, contractors, subcontractors, owners, facilities managers, you know, that's what the website says. So
that's our entire industry.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's all of us. So yeah.
I'm going through as you're talking, Amy, and I'm looking at the pricing and seeing like, you know, how it changes across, you know, audience segments. Why, help me, I don't understand, why would facility managers and building owners, it seems like their pricing is different than everybody else's.
I can't answer how or why pricing was determined, but
yeah, like if you're a building owner or a facility manager and your revenue is between 0 and 10 million and you do between 7 and 10 projects a year, you pay $9,800. But if you're a specifier and you're doing like up to 10 million, your price is like $3,199 a year.
I don't know. Like the only thing I can assume is that some people use more numbers than the other. I don't know. What's the price of a number? Like how much is one going for? How much is two going for? Like
There is a tool on the website that unless you're in the higher end of those categories, it gives you some transparency on how they intend to charge their licensing fees based on people reporting back to CSI what their revenue is. So it's based on us reporting our own revenue back to CSI, and then that determines the licensing fee per firm, not per individual.
Yeah, per firm.
And where would anybody be inclined to do that again? Like, I'm just trying to get, like, I'm being a little bit sarcastic here. Like, I've been told that my sarcastic voice doesn't always come through, so I cannot have to, like, make it explicit that I'm being sarcastic. But I guess my concern with that is, and if you look on the website, you also see that there is a coming soon product that's noting, like, master product, right? And then my concern with that is a tool like Master Product would be a tool that, in my view, would compete directly with the like a company like Bibliotech. It would likely compete directly with a company like AceLab, right? And if like a company like Bibliotech is subject to this licensing and then CSI then has a competing product, well, if I'm, and again, like this is purely hypothetical, but like if I'm controlling who gets these licenses, and I control how much these licenses go for, then what's stopping me from being like, hey, you know what, AceLab, I don't like you very much. Your license has just gone up, right? Like, and Bibliotech, you know what, you're doing a little bit too well right now. License just goes up, right? Again, completely hypothetical. But if I was, say, evil mastermind, and I'm not saying that they are, but like I can see how, you know, getting access to some of that, what I call competitor intelligence, would then, you know, can change the incentives of the people who are setting the prices for these licenses, right? So I think that that's deeply problematic. And I think that that also raises concerns about what we call competition in Canada. And I think that you guys call it antitrust in the US. But it definitely raises concerns because if somebody who's supposed to be a standard setting organization, like i.e. almost like a neutral party who's kind of like setting the game, right? Like, you guys use this standard, like, this is what we're doing. And for many years, like, I mean, I have tons of emails from CSI who's saying, hey, like, you know, what are your ideas for new numbers? Like, do you want to, like, help us just kind of, like, get new numbers for the next edition? Like, you know, there's all this marketing information that went out and said, please help us update the standard, right? So tons and tons of people have been making suggestions, right? Some of them have been agreed, some of them have been approved, some of them have not been approved. But all that work has kind of like gone in, right? So in my view, it's kind of like a collective endeavor, right? If you will. And, you know, you kind of like go around and then like start saying, okay, well, thanks for all your efforts. Now you have to pay. To me, there's like ethical concerns to be raised, right? But there's also like concerns about how that presentations that were being made to the people who contributed, in the sense that, like, if I know, like, if Islab comes to me and say, hey, help me update my software, I'm like, well, no, you're a competitor. Why would I do that? Right. So, but if it's like different from like, hey, like, you know, it's like, hey, you know, do us a favor and do this, like, this is going to be for the benefit of the industry, then, you know, people might have contributed not knowing that their work was then going to be turned around and being monetized. And I think that that's why a lot of people feel slighted right now, because, like, I mean, some people have poured like a lot, like a big portion of their life into this, right? Like, I mean, I'm talking about like, you know, like recitals for their kids, like so that they could go and volunteer. Like, I'm talking about like, you know, things that like they had to sacrifice to be able to kind of like do all these things for the association. And to me, to turn around and start kind of like saying, okay, now you have to pay for that same work that you volunteered to do. Again, like, I don't know about the legal things, but I think like even on an ethical thing, like, I think that it definitely raises some concerns.
And that, I think, is an important thing to flag, because it's free labor. I think the people who volunteered were doing it for like the improvement of the industry and standards. And that was the context that they had in front of them too. But in the for-profit world, if even like it was not free, or like they were incentivized some way, I think it'd be fair. Like, you know, Acelab, SpecLink, the providers, we also have advisory boards, but the people who serve on those boards, we're not expecting them just to volunteer. We're expecting, or, you know, like for some sort of a compensation. It could be free subscription. It could be some other things, access to features and so on. So that certainly is an important area. Our audience.
To add, just like from my perspective, you know, in marketing, a lot of times when an RFP goes out, the brand will actually pay a nominal fee for your submission, say like $2,000, you know, you're going to put way more than $2,000 into it. But the reason that they do it is because then they own the IP. If you submit an RFP and they don't pay for it, that remains your IP. So by what you're describing, Joost, it's sort of like the IP that it's been built on isn't even their IP, because it was volunteer based, right? You know, following that thread, you know, like.
And that raises some really, really good points, Megan. Like, I think that there are many ways to kind of like look at what they claim is their IP and then try to kind of like go back and say, hey, is that actually your IP? And then that's being decided in court right now, right? So I think that, like, you know, we'll find out soon enough in the Zerodox case. But yeah, no, certainly. I think that if they didn't have all the people, well, not only the volunteers who kind of like decided yes or no, we're going to include that number, but say, you know, Varden went on that website and kind of like said, here's a number that I propose. And, you know, Varden didn't actually like, and then that gets put into the publication, but Varden didn't assign the right, then can CSI really kind of like quote unquote own that number?
Own it. Because, yeah.
Right. So I think that, again, like, there's a lot of these things that are, again, I'm going to come out in the litigation, but I think that the basis, the legal basis that they're founding this whole licensing scheme on, in my view, is a little bit shaky. And I think that it's worthwhile kind of like monitoring these cases a little bit to see where that goes before kind of like, you know, making certain decisions. Because yeah, if like, you know, if I come to you and say, well, you owe me $2,000 because you used my IP, your first question would be like, hey, show me the proof of that ownership. And then I'm sure, like, you know, then we can kind of like talk, right? But it's, you know, right now it's not clear.
The legal part is certainly something that I think a lot of people are going to be following as, you know, we see how this turns out. But on the CSI membership side, we've also seen a lot of people raising their concerns about that very issue, meaning, you know, there's a lot of people that have donated a lot of time, a lot of people that care deeply about the health and the future of the organization. And I think that, you know, I myself, I didn't see this coming. And I think a lot of people have voiced their concerns being in kind of the same boat. We just didn't see it coming. So what you're seeing online, I think, is it's a lot to do with a lack of transparency and communication that this was coming and the reasons why it was coming. So we're trying to, at this point in time, we're trying to figure out how this all came to pass. You know, there's a lot of questions that they're trying to answer and some that we don't yet have answers to. So that's kind of where we're at today.
I know you guys don't represent manufacturers, but I'm sure you guys work with a lot of manufacturers or have a lot of dialogue with them. If you were in the sales, product, marketing teams at any manufacturer that you know, you've worked with in the past, what would be the questions, thoughts that you would be factoring in to, like, how to think about all of this, how to report about this to your C-suite and so on?
I do know that, so it has nothing to do with this CSI piece, but in the past, unrelated to what we know about the licensing for CSI products, I've been asked by manufacturers many times over, like, hey, I've heard of this new cataloging tool. Hey, I've heard of this new search tool that's come online in the industry. And I have X amount of dollars every year that I assign to being a subscriber to each of these different ways to bring awareness to our brand as a manufacturer. And I often get asked for my opinion on the usage of various search and cataloging tools as a specifier, because manufacturers do have limited budgets to, you know, become a subscriber of many different platforms. There's a lot of different ways to search information now, and those decisions are looked at very carefully on the manufacturer side. So all of that to say, I'm sure that this will come up if and when, and I'm not even sure how, to be totally honest. I don't understand how the licensing will unfold on the manufacturer side, but I'm sure this is going to be yet another thing that has to be kind of considered moving forward, since it will likely affect your budgets as a manufacturer to be visible to the spec writing community.
Yeah. I mean, I serve as a fractional CMO to a few different building product manufacturers, and then, you know, have a host of other clients that look to me for guidance and maintaining a pulse. And, you know, Amy, very similar to what you just said in terms of, you know, what they're looking for my guidance on. Like, these are important lead generation tools. We actually consider them a form of paid media, you know, like one of the very first forms of any good paid media program in this segment is going to include some sort of product selection specification platforms at the core of it. And what I've told them now is, like, just wait a minute. You know, like, there's lots of things that are going on. You need to be aware of it. It was interesting. I mean, this week I told all of my clients about this. No one knew that it was happening. Some have very little risk. Some have much more risk. You know, some, there are all different cost levels according to the calculator that's available out there. You know, so I'm like, I'm monitoring it. You know, like, I want to make you aware of it, and then we'll come up with a plan as better information becomes available. You know, that's basically what I've been telling them.
I haven't dug in to understand the manufacturer impacts directly because that's not my core business. So I would say definitely for manufacturers to keep an eye on it. I do know of at least a few instances where manufacturers have made me aware that they're starting to receive emails about this. So keep an eye on that, any communications. And, you know, I don't know the extent of it, but I do know that there's emails being sent with information to manufacturers.
Yeah. That's a good segue into what can we do as an industry, what we should be doing as these things unfold. So, Houston, Amy, any general recommendations for the audience from your own experience? How, you know, we talked a lot about, like, this is an issue that may have started on LinkedIn and these social platforms, but is important regardless of which of these stakeholders you might represent for all of us to follow and pay attention to, like the ongoing lawsuits, like where are those headed? What is the enforceability of the construction standard? And do you guys have any other sort of recommendations for the audience, which again, may be primarily manufacturer based here, but then I'm sure there's also other folks from the other stakeholder groups here listening to this.
Sure. I think that obviously it goes without saying, if you have legal questions, you should consult legal counsel. That is ideally something that would happen when you're working with somebody that has a background in copyright also. So that's apparently a niche specialization that not everybody is super familiar with.
You can reach out to Juiced as well. He's basically there.
Talk to Juiced about it. But beyond that, you know, if you're a CSI member, you are encouraged to reach out to the board. If you are a member, you do have a board representative for your region who might be a good first point of contact because they're more local to you. But certainly they have provided an email address to collect all questions and concerns that goes to the national board, which, you know, I'm sure that they've been overwhelmed with emails and responses. So you do have to give them a little bit of time to try to respond, but they've provided an email for questions. I think that just sort of like bringing awareness to it is important because it was sort of like a thing that caught everybody by surprise. I have been, you know, obviously posting about it and asking questions. And I think that that has brought some awareness to this. You know, I'm actually on the local board for my CSI chapter. And I think that, you know, my responsibility to my chapter, for which I'm a board of directors member, is to make sure that they have the information. So I hope that we're able to communicate what's needed and answer questions as best we're able to. But, you know, at this point, we're still asking questions of our national board, and they're in the process of trying to respond to those right now.
Yeah. And to add to that, Amy, what I would also like to note is I think that the awareness piece is important, but I think that we have to kind of like make sure like the right people are aware. And I think that like from my end, it was just making sure that whoever mandates these standards is actually aware of the potential implications that like this mandate of these standards is going to have, right? Because for example, like in Canada, we have a big procurement group from the government, which is called Public Service and Procurement Canada. It's very similar to your GSA. And I wrote to them and I said, hey, by the way, well, first of all, the government usually has a mandate to be fair and impartial. But if you are now mandating that I use this format, that is now kind of like everybody's kind of like, well, they are not asking for a fee on that. Well, not only am I going to reflect that fee in my bids to you, and those fees are just going to flow down. But how is that also impartial? And I don't know if you heard, but like, we're not very happy about the whole 51st state stuff in Canada. So there's a little bit of that as well. So I don't think that they'll be happy that like some of the kind of like the procurement money that they're kind of like putting into it is now going to flow out of the country. Right. So there's that portion of it. But I think that like definitely speak to your legal counsel as well and try to understand, like in Canada, like I've been in touch with the Competition Bureau. That's our regulator on competition and making sure that the market is fair, right? And that there is no dominant player abusing, like using certain practices that kind of like distort the market. So we've been in touch. I've kind of like lodged a complaint with them. And I said, hey, look, like these guys are going to make it really hard for the industry to innovate, right? So certainly speak like with counsel and see if there's any action that you can take. If you think that it's unfair, or if like, you know, counsel finds that it's unfair, then see if there's any action that you can take with some of your regulators. Because by all means, to what Amy was saying before, it's not like we can just say, oh, you know what, we're not going to use master format anymore. We're going to use this right now, because there's lock-in that has happened due to very deep industry integration, right? Like if kind of like, you know, when the government is mandating it, then, you know, you kind of like build everything around so you can like fit that client. That kind of integration cannot happen cannot just be undone overnight. So I think that there's deeper issues here that we have to kind of like look into and that people want to start kind of like thinking about as well.
Well, guys, that was great. I mean, I certainly learned, I knew a lot because we've been getting ready for this, but I also learned a lot through the session today. So I'm sure that our listeners are going to really appreciate the background and the information and the resources that you guys were able to provide to us. So thanks for being a part of this, our Inside the Spec podcast, and for bringing all your wealth of knowledge and experience to the table here, because there's a lot of people that are going to be able to benefit from it.
You're welcome.